Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Canada's recently adopted so-called online safety measures join those of Five Eyes partners Australia, Britain, and New Zealand. Touted as necessary to protect the tender sensibilities of youngsters, the legislation is coercive and punitive and serves instead to enforce media control for the cognitive war currently being fought in the brains and guts of a captured citizenry. John Helmer is the principal behind the news and analysis website Dances with Bears, an author and journalist. John's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. His academic career includes teaching at Harvard and serving as political advisor to presidents and prime ministers. John's book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison Which Fooled the World, and Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. His latest at Dances with Bears is Would the Last War Against Russia Have Turned Out Differently If Joseph Goebbels Launched Podcasts Instead of the V2 Rocket? Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's very happy for me to be back.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course, and we spoke, I guess, about 6 weeks ago, which seems like a century in today's media cycle. John, you begin your recent article, not your latest, with a quote from President Putin disparaging European politicians for saying Russia is planning to bomb them for aiding Ukraine in bombing Russia. Well, why would it be a blatant lie, then, that Putin would want to target the Europeans who are manufacturing drones and Volkswagen, for example, and make them weapons-making factories to produce drones to gift to the Ukrainians to bomb Russian school buses with? You know, why wouldn't why would it be a lie that he would want to target the source of this in Europe?
I think you've put it around a different way, Chris. President Putin is saying it's a lie on the NATO and the particular European side to say that Russia is using the Ukraine battlefield as the first step in advancing westward to capture or influence or control or dictate the future of the European states, whether they're the Baltic states, Poland, the Nordic and Scandinavian states like Finland and Sweden and Denmark, or the Central European powers, Germany and France, or England. What he's saying is, we aren't doing that. What you're saying is, why would he not retaliate when they all participate, when in fact there's been a Ukrainization, a very ugly word, but it's an ugly process, of a drone war, so that Germany begins to manufacture drones, Britain manufactures drones. The European powers are at plants, the exact address, street address of which the Russian Defense Ministry has published, are now diversifying their form of war against Russia by supplying the drones. You're saying, why wouldn't Putin retaliate at the source, attack the German plant at its street address? The street address the Defense Ministry published last week. Why wouldn't he do that? I say he says that he will, or he's thinking about it to satisfy the vast majority of Russian public opinion as measured in the polls, and the majority of the Security Council, that advises him and takes collective decisions, he's saying he will, or he's thinking of doing, to address them. On the other hand, he's not doing it and won't to address the faction led by advisors like Kirill Dmitriev, the central bank chief, Elvira Nabiulina, the finance minister, Anton Sulwanov, and the staff around Putin and Putin himself. He's telling them, please make as best you can, as quickly as you can, whatever good relations, business relations, bribery relations you can with the Americans, and get Trump to intervene and oppose the European war. So he's saying he will do for one faction, he's acting in such a way as to assure the other faction he won't do it. Look, there are several issues here. What's the proof of what I've just said? Well, the level of restriction President Putin has placed on his own general staff for targeting inside Ukraine indicates he will not attack the fundamental structure of European supply to the Ukraine. The railroads still run unhindered from Poland and Romania into Ukraine to supply the drones now being manufactured or assembled outside. If Putin won't continue the electricity campaign we've often talked about, the electric war campaign, to cut the power off the entire military-industrial complex, then inside the Ukraine, he's not attacking the NATO targets. Outside the Ukraine, his argument with those who say he should is that this would trigger Article 5 consultations between the NATO states. It would draw Trump inevitably into a commitment to war against Russia, which Putin says Trump has promised him he will not do, will not engage, will not promise. So Putin's argument, it's a reasonable argument. I'm trying to say it's a reasonable and arguable case. If he retaliates outside the battlefield against NATO, as Russian public opinion, as the talk shows, as the Security Council all suggest, and as Putin himself has hinted, if he does that, he ends the opportunity, closes the opportunity for what we've called, what he calls, what the Russian media called, the Anchorage formula. The Anchorage formula refers to Putin's meeting with Trump August 15, a year ago, in Anchorage, Alaska. And Putin has come away with a 2-hour, 15-minute conversation, which he did most of the talking to Trump. And then Trump ended the entire summit and went home, skipping the lunch. Putin is saying Trump promised a U.S. guarantee for Russian security in Europe for the future. That's the crux, a center, the core of the Anchorage formula. At the same time, Russian intelligence and everyone else's intelligence tells you that, as you just said, Chris, Germany's rearming. Reason to fight Russia, defend Germany against Russia. Putin calls that a lie. Yes, it's a lie. But the underlying imperial and German structure, infrastructure for rearmament is a political driver, is an economic driver in that country. And it's not changing German policy. It's not changing German propaganda. And the same process is underway in France, in Greece, in Finland, in Sweden. The dynamics of the way economies work are the same. Where do we end up? Putin doesn't attack the delivery of NATO weapon systems as they move across the Polish border. He could have, he hasn't. He could have used an Oreshnik at the hubs, but he didn't. He dropped a demonstration effect on Belaya Tserkva in that region, as he's had demonstration effects in eastern Ukraine. Why? We have three demonstration effects of doing what he won't do inside Ukraine. Another example would be the NATO forces, particularly the British and Americans, send unmanned drones into the Black Sea where they gather intelligence on the Crimea, Russian radars and air defenses in the Crimea and on the shore, in order to guide Ukrainian naval and air drones to attack those targets. And yet, has Putin shot one of those unmanned devices down? No, he hasn't. Have the Hezbollah, has Iran, has Ansar Allah shot down US drones? Yes, they have. Why hasn't Putin done it? He dropped petrol out of a jet fighter on one of those drones to bring it down. Why didn't he shoot it down? If he won't shoot down a NATO drone in the Black Sea in a war operation, when the Arab resistance and Iran shows that's what they do when they see these drones approaching for warfare purposes against them, then you can't take President Putin's red line seriously. It's just another yellow flash, and NATO and the Americans cross it.
Yeah, you're right. I did read that wrong, thinking more that he was reacting to what the Europeans say, that they are in the Russian crosshairs, and this is how they scare their own populations. Why he wouldn't agree with that? Well, Dmitry Medvedev was seen. You were talking on I think it was Jamal Thomas. Putting photographs of European leaders into a faux ballot box that was really a shredder, and grinning because, yeah, we are, we don't like the Europeans, and we blame, we're going to show them. Well, they're not showing them anything, but not putting a picture of Donald Trump into it. I know you can't answer this either, John, but I mean, how long are they, Putin and Putin's Russia, willing to wait as America circles them and targets them and kills their school children in buses and in dormitories before lashing out and taking that step across the border? I mean, it's going to have to happen sooner or later.
Is it going to have to happen? I can tell you, and I apologize to our Canadian audience, yours is my first loyalty, Chris. We've been together a long time on Guerrilla Radio. Guerrilla Radio leads, and so I really don't want to repeat things I've said on other programs with other colleagues. It's kind of you to give a shout out to Jamal and others, but let me try and say something fresh without repeating myself. Politics is a short-term business. It's a local business. Americans understand that very well. Congressional politics and presidential politics run like that. And there's no reason not to see Putin acting in the same way. He has a midterm election of his own in September, and he's facing a significant rise in opposition sentiment, which may reflect itself in the ballot box. To run in an election, a national parliamentary election, when you're at war, when you've got significant casualties coming home, at the same time as you've got food price inflation and rising and recession conditions in the country, that combination of blood and economic price usually kills incumbents. It always does in the United States. It usually does elsewhere. The only way incumbents survive that combination is to make peace and stop the blood flow, change economic policy, and improve people's social welfare and social hopes, or by repression, and election fraud. Those are the methods that everyone uses in politics. And you cover the repression and ballot fraud with propaganda. Propaganda doesn't work against blood, against casualties, against war casualties. Propaganda doesn't work against real recession. You can't jawbone people who are feeling it seriously in the pocket. So that's where Russia is right now. And in the short term, President Putin's got to do two things. He's got to reduce the majority of opposition that may emerge so that the United Russia ruling party will not control the State Duma on September 21. He's got to do that. Second, he's got to prepare for his own presidential succession. To be sure, there's no Russian presidential election for a long time off yet, 2030. But he's got to prepare for a presidential succession in a political climate in which he's not sharing and dividing power with an opposition parliament, in which the leading votes might be communist, might be the Communist Party, not the current Communist Party under Gennady Zyuganov, but a Communist Party and other opposition parties, which combined, which represent a significant challenge to virtually every economic policy President Putin is proposing, guided by the Nabi Ulina, the governor of the central bank, and finance minister Silvanov. They represent anti-inflation, high central bank interest rate to crush inflation, and cutting military expenses to cut the budget deficit. That's what they're publicly running on. It's a disastrous platform for a president, politician of any kind in any place to run on. So politics is short term. You said, Chris, you said it right. Sooner or later, mustn't Russia react and react against this permanent war against Russia for the long term? Answer, politicians don't think in the long term. They think short term. How to preserve power, how to preserve votes, how to preserve my freedom of decision. So short term means September 18 to 20 in Moscow. And then it means after September 21, when the ballots are counted, how to share power or how to preserve power to finalize some form of peace deal on American terms or on Russian terms that would answer the fundamental Russian war aims: demilitarization of the Ukraine, denazification of the Ukraine. Well, to put it quickly, demilitarization of the Ukraine battlefield seemed one thing in 2022 when the sides were negotiating in Istanbul and drone warfare hadn't become a long-range European-American operation. And let's not diminish the role of the U.S. satellite systems and intelligence systems in guiding these drones wherever they're made. There were no drone restrictions in the 2022 draft agreement worked out in Istanbul. Now, drone warfare against Russia goes deep into the hinterland. It goes into deep into the Russian energy structure. It goes deep into Russia's international high seas trade. The drones are attacking Russian ships, or they're being intercepted in the English Channel and off the coast of France in the Mediterranean Sea. It's a high seas drone warfare that the Ukrainians, the Americans, Europeans are all waging. So demilitarizing the Ukrainian battlefield now means protecting Russia's security from NATO all over the world. Is that what President Trump can offer and guarantee? No, he can't. Does it help that President Putin says it's the Europeans, dear Donald, who are interfering with you? Control the Europeans. Dear Donald says, I'll control the Europeans. Well, he can't. He won't. Why? Well, his record shows that that he doesn't, that it's very profitable for the Trump administration in their personal pockets and in their institutional and corporate profits, and even in their budget, is very profitable to let the Europeans pay for American technology to attack Russia. It's very profitable for the United States to now have a monopoly of liquefied natural gas supply, LNG supply to Germany. Germany is now more dependent on US for energy supply than it was dependent on Russia for gas before the Nord Stream 2 was blown up.
And at a greater cost as well. You've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's the principal behind the web news and analysis site Dances with Bears. He's an author and journalist living and reporting from Russia for decades. His book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison Which Fooled the World, and Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and many more. We're talking around his latest article at Dances with Bears. Would the last war against Russia have turned out differently if Joseph Goebbels launched podcasts instead of the V2 rocket. Sorry to step in on you like that, John. We're fast running out of time, and I want to get to something. First of all, and you've got a recent article, several newer articles from when I wrote my script. The Iran Memorandum of Understanding is a stick-up. Trump will try to repeat with Russia is the latest. And in that, you write something interesting, and this is in correlation with what you just said, and I'll quote you, "Hors de combat in war means you're either KIA, killed in action, or too wounded to fight on. In politics, you aren't KIA if your pockets keep filling up." I've thought long about this war in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, as less of a war, a phony war, a war of profit for certain actors. The main goal is to keep the war going, to keep the money filling the pockets, so to speak. And in your article, you quote a NATO warfighting veteran saying that, "I believe they are," and he's talking about podcasters in this case, "but essentially all on the same side. No one wants things to change. There's too much money in keeping the ball rolling," that ball being this gross war of attrition that now, as you mentioned, has gone into a technological overdrive that I don't think people, or most of the people fighting it, really saw coming. It makes a shamble of the original aims, Putin's original aims of denazification and demilitarization. We've talked about, you know, the pushing the borders back but the missiles have a range that makes that ridiculous. Like when Putin was trying to have some kind of demilitarized zone, there are no zones anymore. I mean, as you're pointing out right now, where does this leave us, John, in the last few minutes we've got here, with a war that nobody seems to want to stop, at least the ones that are running it?
Let's talk Canadian here, Chris. Mm. Let's talk Canadian. How can Russia negotiate with Trump for a guarantee for the denazification of the Ukraine when nazification has become the ruling doctrine in Canada? When Parliament rose in Ottawa to give 3 standing ovations to a fascist murderer, hunker in the gallery, put there by Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland then, and the Prime Minister then, Justin Trudeau, how come Canadians not understand? Of course you all understand. Canada is nazified, not just in the war against Russia. It comes with RCMP intervention to repress all forms of resistance, opposition, political debate, whether it all over Canada, all over the issues. And it's not just Canada. Nazification is the ruling party doctrine in the UK, in France, in Italy, in Greece, and public opposition and resistance. You began with it, Chris, and I agree with you, and our audience knows it every day they turn on one of their devices. Resistance is being repressed through the internet system, through the press media systems, through every form of transaction that's monitored digitally. We face nazification in all our countries. We face nazification at the cash register and the gas pump and so forth and so on. I'm not telling Canadians what they don't already know. The fact that Canada's general staff, the prime minister previous, the current prime minister, without Freeland, the fact that Canada continues to support the war against Russia is part of the propaganda justification for a complete underlying restructuring of the Canadian economy, A, so that it becomes more subservient to the United States, B, so that it becomes more profitable to build weapons, and so forth and so on. I mean, I'm telling you what you already know, but nazification can't be a Russian war aim when it's the ruling doctrine of the entire Western alliance, isn't it?
Well, and isn't it in Russia too? Isn't Putin playing along with this? I mean, isn't isn't Russia now under Putin not the opposition to Nazism, but a collaborator?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that to the great credit and memory of the roughly 200,000 Russians who've died fighting against this, Russia has its own domestic battles. Mm-hmm. Yes, their class battles too. The concern for security that is justifying the crackdown on the on Telegram, for example, and other digital communications, the crackdown on the internet and the suspension of internet coverage, that's chiefly objected to by the young, and the young also are afraid of being mobilized to fight the war on the front. And so we have a particularly sharp contest at the moment between the young urbanites, the better off, better educated population who want to preserve their digital freedoms, in a war-fighting situation in which the government is increasingly imposing surveillance and repression on all forms of communication, transaction, movement, and so on. So, yes, there's the same trend in Russia. Yes, it's a repressive trend. We go into an election, we face potential ballot fraud, we face repression and propaganda to cover all of that up. Yes, we have the same trends. Do we have the same outcome? I don't think so. We have a different set of values in Russia compared to the Germans, for Christ's sake, or the British, or the French. We have a very strong public support for those traditional values, call them family values, call them conservatism, if you like. That's another debate.
Well, yeah. Well, we don't have time. Sorry, John. We don't have time for it here. We're right out of time. But yeah, those countries you named too, they would say, yeah, and we have a long history of fighting Nazism, and we can't be the Nazis.
They don't have a very long history. They were collaborators. The British, the German, collaborated in Hitler's rise. They thought that the enemy was Soviet communism at the time. Doesn't have a history of anything better than collaboration. And how was Germany defeated? Principally by the Russian, the Red Army. The Red Army was the signal most important force that ended the war against fascism in Europe. And now fascism is coming back to try to finish off what Hitler failed to do in 45.
Well, that's not the version of history that we get taught over here. Remember that
we're... Sorry about that, but guerrilla radio is the version of history. You've got a banana on your beret.
Two.
And everyone else in the world slips on that banana skin, but not us. Hey, Chris?
Okay. John, it's always a joy to speak with you. And thanks go out to Jeremy Kuzmarov as well over there at covertactionmagazine.com. Go over there and check it out. It's good for your soul. And he passes on his salutations, and he's very laudatory towards your work as well during the interview that we held earlier this morning. Thanks again, John, for coming on, and I do look forward to our next talk.
Thank you for having me, Chris, and good luck to all our Canadian audience to have some hope that Nazification of Canada will also be resisted successfully.
Well, that's all I got for this week. Till the next time.
about reality.